you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bassell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and Amazon Prime.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in pre-production on my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep who used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome writer and showrunner Debbie Wolf on the show to talk about being the creator showrunner of Lopez vs. Lopez and how she landed that show after working her way up in writer's rooms. After that, we play another round of Ask the Experts. Maybe? Is it Ask the Expert or is it You're the Expert? Because we keep on going back and forth about that, but we'll land on one of those at some point.
I thought you said Ask last week, so I remember.
No, and then Eric today sent me a You're the Expert, and then he texted us, it's You're the Expert. Who knows? It's an expert. No. We're just call it like the expert round. After that, we play another round of expert questions. But first, Ulrich, how are you doing?
I feel like a little like depressed of myself that I can't remember the name of the segment that we do every week. But I think I should let that go and not dwell on that.
Yeah.
No, I'm good. I'm at page 52 of rewriting.
Yay!
The new movie, which I don't even have a title for it. The title I have for it is stupid, so I can't keep that title. I actually have to think of a title because I'm going to start submitting it to the script competitions. I'm going to do Austin, which is a week or two away, and then I might do Screencraft maybe, and then I didn't do Nichols because it was last week, and then also because it's too much money, and I just don't think, like, the script wasn't ready. It was just like, why rush it and blow $70 or $80 or whatever it is for no reason? It just seems silly. But I'm going to do Slam Dance. I think I'm going to do the Final Draft Big Break one because I read good things about that. So I think
ISA. Those are like kind of the main ones. What about ISA, Ulrich?
We'll see. Let's see if they get my submission. Probably. But yeah, no. So that's sort of where I'm at with that. But I'm just like reading through it, getting really excited. I feel like I'm seeing the movie come together in my mind, and I'm seeing how this could be shot around here, you know, and I kind of feel like I see it as, like, when I read the movie, I see it as being, like, happening in Vallejo, you know, so it's like I can sort of see it all kind of coming together, and there's a couple, like, there's a lot of warehouse space here that I'm just like, I gotta start getting in contact with people, because, like, I know a lot of it, there's just nothing happening. It's just empty. So, like, I'm sure I can get a good deal if I find the right place, you know? And because, like, we'll need to build sets. And it's just, like, building the sets and getting those. It's, like, that's always, like, the crazy part, you know? And so I think if we do that well and properly and, like, get a good deal, like, that could really save us. I also don't have any money. So that's another thing.
Who does? But, who has money to make indie
planning films? Planning it ahead of time is nice. So you get it all planned out, get it all figured out, figure out what the budget's going to be, and then I can start trying to beat bushes. I mean, obviously getting the script done and sent out to people is like the first step. So I have a bunch of people to send it to, and then we'll see from there, you know? Yeah, I don't feel well physically, but that's okay. What's the other thing? I feel like there was something else I want to talk about. I was really excited by our talk with Matt Farley. On Friday, it really blew my mind. I was like talking about him all weekend and how great he is.
Me too.
And like how I should write a song. And not like because to write 25,000 songs, but just if I could write one song, then maybe I could write another song. And then maybe I could write another song. And then eventually maybe I'd have 10 songs and I could have an album. And then, you know, if I liked doing it, if it was fun, then do it again. If not, never do it again. But like at least try.
Yeah.
But, you know, also realizing I'm not like really a musician, really, per se, kind of, not really, but I've been singing to my children so much, like, since they've been born. Like, I sing to my children, like, probably 4 to 5 times a day, if not more, and I, like, sing a lot at night to BB. I'm just, like, singing all the time, so I'm like, damn, like, you know, maybe I should just try writing my own song and see what happens, you know, so.
Well, anyways. I think you should, and it's kind of like, you and I meet artists all the time who are like afraid of saying that they're a filmmaker because they're like haven't earned it yet or something. And I think that's ridiculous. So it's like, how do you know you're not a musician? Ulrich, you might be a musician.
I mean, I'm a musician in the sense that I can play some songs.
Yeah. So you're a musician.
But, but I've never written any. So I feel to me, writing a song is like, that's what will make me a musician. Like, I can't really say
that's a composer.
I'm a musician, whatever.
I'm just saying, like, call yourself a musician now and a composer later.
Fair enough, I guess. I do play like 5 times a week or 4 times a week. So maybe I am a musician. I don't know. And I just didn't know it. That's interesting. You learn new things about yourself every day. Anyways, how are you doing?
Good. So 2 things that I wanted to mention. One is I received in the mail a book from Ben Stier, Stier, who is a lovely guest on our podcast whose show is going to air in a few weeks. And I sent him a thank you note, but just wanted to thank him again on the podcast. He sent just a book about Lillian Gish and D.W. Griffith, and it's super cool. And I can't wait to crack into it. And the second thing to mention is I'm in this very unusual situation right now where the contract ended on my distributor of my first feature. Bread and Butter is no longer with 1091. And if anyone pays attention to indie film distribution, they know that 1091 has been in some trouble for quite some time. So I got out at an appropriate time. But now I can do whatever I want with my movie. And it's like the weirdest thing. It's not available really anywhere right now. I mean, maybe a few platforms have been a little delayed in taking it down. But I was like, I could just put it on YouTube. I could just do Vimeo. I could go with indie rights and see if they want to put it on an AVOD, and I can get access to those revenue reports that everyone talks about. Like, it's just like a really fun situation because every day I advise filmmakers on what they should do with their films. And I'm like, wow, I get to turn the tables on myself right now and advise myself on what to do with this movie in its 9th year of distribution right now.
Wow, that's amazing.
Pretty cool.
Are you thinking that you might just self-distribute and just do it that way?
I just want to do anything that doesn't involve E&O insurance, really. That's kind of when it's like anything where I don't have to put down $3,000 to $5,000 that I'm never going to get back is what I'm interested in. So,
interesting.
I'll try different platforms. I was thinking of just putting it on YouTube, to be honest, because I was excited about that option. But I'm going to talk to my crew, and Indie Rights said they'll take it. So it's either Indie Rights or self distribution right now.
And Indie Rights, you don't have to do E&O insurance for them.
No,
that's nice.
Yeah,
yeah. Indie Rights seems like a good move. You know.
Yeah, I got lots to say. I won't say it on the podcast, but I mean, I think it a decent option for many, many filmmakers.
And what's up with the casting of your movie? Any updates there?
We're still waiting to hear from our big offer. She's on set of a show that's shooting right now, and so it's just waiting. I am feeling like this is not happening this summer, which is like a curious recognition to have. We're still going to crowdfund like in a month, probably. We're still going to try our best to make it happen. But I just don't feel, I don't know. I it's like hard to admit. It's not defeat, but it's hard to admit the truth because I was like, so like hell or high water, we're doing this. And then I just am realizing that there's a limit to my energy. I hate saying that. I hate admitting that there's a limit to what I can do. And it's such a depressing thought. But I think there is a limit to how much energy I have and how much time I have.
Well, everyone has limits. That shouldn't be depressing.
It's so sad to me.
What did you have dates already set that you'd put forward that you?
Yeah, they were.
Shoot?
You know, like they're in June. Like that's 2 months away. It's not going to happen in June, but it could still happen in July or August. It's just, will we be ready enough? I'm not going to rush for rushing's sake. And if my son misses, if my husband misses every day on set, you know, that's okay. We're going to work it out and not disturb my son's lifestyle.
What do you need that you don't have besides the money that you're uncertain about? Is it just like locations and, you know, the plan and all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I'm meeting with my line producer tomorrow. We have a budget and breakdown and day out of days and all these things, but it's not based off of the most recent script. So we're doing a new one. We're going to make sure that we know exactly what we can make this movie for in an ideal world. And so we're going to redo everything. And then, you know, I have the crew. I have a lot of cast members that are on the Dreamcast list. It's no shortage of people I want to work with. I would say what we're missing is a partner in the special effects makeup world who, like, we have tons of recommendations. I just haven't found the exact person yet who can be like our Tom Savini, you know, like who's the one who really wants, not want, because it's like we're not offering an amazing opportunity in terms of financially, but who's like the creative partner who gets exactly what we're doing and is flexible enough to help make it happen with us. So that I think is the missing piece too.
Interesting. Nice.
Yeah, but let's not talk about that anymore. Let's talk about Patreon. We are currently running a Patreon campaign, patreon.com/MMIH podcast. Please support us on there. Every dollar goes to the making of the show. And without any more delay, here is Eric Toms, our producer's chat with Debbie Wolf.
Debbie Wolf, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We absolutely appreciate you coming here.
Thank you for having me.
You, of course, are the showrunner for Lopez versus Lopez on NBC. Mm-hmm. Give me the elevator pitch for Lopez versus Lopez.
Lopez versus Lopez is a father-daughter story. Mm-hmm. It stars George Lopez, the comedian, and his real-life daughter, Mayan Lopez. And it's actually based on their real life. They actually didn't speak for many years, and over the pandemic reconnected and decided they wanted to have a relationship. So the show is about them healing their past and building a future where they're bonded.
Now, you are credited as one of the show creators along with George and Mayan Lopez. So how mm-hmm. did you all meet? How did that all come about?
So I actually, you know, during the pandemic, you know, like many people, I turned to TikTok for entertainment. And so I would be up to like 3-4 in the morning on TikTok. And my algo knows that I love like anything Latine. So I'm Salvadoran, half Salvadorian. And so Mayan Lopez popped up on my TikTok one day. And it was this TikTok where she was clearing up some rumors about her father and her mother's relationship. But she's basically like calling out her father for cheating on her mom, and then her mom getting a huge settlement, and she was twerking upside down, and I thought it was hilarious.
Wow, you buried the lead on that one.
Yeah. and it was like, yeah, and I was like, this is hilarious. I watched it maybe like 50 times that night, and I had worked on The Conners with Bruce Helford, who created the original George Lopez show, mm-hmm. and I emailed him at 3 a.m. and said, I think this is how we bring George back to network television. It's a show with his daughter, and they've obviously gone through some stuff. Uh-huh. He's like, I agree. And I was like, okay, great. And then I met George and Mayan, and I pitched them. I was like, I want to do something like the Gilmore Girls, but with the Lopezes. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, we're in. And they're just like so amazing from the very start. Like, they were just so open about their struggles. And I was like, gosh, like this is how we're going to resonate with an audience, is just telling authentic stories, which they are very, like, they're such great muses.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners who want to become showrunners, really, mm-hmm. the just watch TikTok videos.
Yes. Really, yeah. I think we're the only sitcom probably created from a TikTok, actually.
I
think it made history.
Give it time.
Yeah. Yeah. So far.
So what was the development process like? I mean, you talking about them being so giving, being so open. So yeah. What were you bringing to the table? Because it's clearly this is very sensitive subject matter. You know, mm-hmm. you are an outsider coming in to someone's family. So yeah. what was that process like? And what were you doing as a person? And then what were you doing as a writer?
Yeah, well, naturally, you know, I'm a comedy writer, so obviously I have daddy issues. So I definitely related to Mayan Lopez. So I connected with her immediately. And what I did is I met with them separately and I talked to them. I just asked them a lot of questions about the history, about the joy and the pain and all of that, all in between. And they were just so honest. And I just like kind of wrote everything down. I was also living with my parents at the time during the pandemic. And so I was getting a lot of stimulation,
no shade.
A lot of inspiration.
It's fine. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just a lot of inspo from that situation. So it was just kind of all these things like came together, and then I was able to develop the show. And then it was really interesting from the very first pitch, like we knew we had something special. You know, we sold it to multiple networks and there was a bidding war, and we ended up at our home NBC, which I'm really grateful for, because they're just so great to us. They just saw that this was like a story that was going to resonate with a lot of people. And it was just like fire. Like, it was like pilot pickup. And then it was like, pilot's great, like tested well, you know, series pickup. It just all happened so fast. And overnight I was a showrunner. I went from, I was writing on sitcoms for 10 years. So I was ready.
Yeah.
But still, you're never really ready.
Yeah.
Well, thrown into it.
How long was that? If you're going from like, okay, I think we've got a good pilot script here. Mm-hmm. And are you putting together like a pitch deck or something? Like, well, what is that kind of looking like?
Well, I had Jordan Mayen, like I had the stars of the show in the pitch with me.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did come up with a pitch where we talked about all the characters, and then like I would have mine or George like pop in, you know, pipe in with like some jokes or just some personal stories. And yeah, and so we didn't really have like I've had pitch decks in the past mm-hmm. for other pitches, but this wasn't necessary since we had the talent in the room.
Oh, terrific. Yeah. And then how long was that from like when you first started to like now we've got a series order?
Oh, I think the whole process was probably from pilot to series order about 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. still a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah, it was. It was very fast and during a pandemic, which was crazy.
Now, you have a lot of experience working with stand-up comics who have then gone on to having shows. From what I found, so one of your first major scripts was for Whitney.
Yes.
So, yeah, tell me, how did you get to that point? I'm assuming we didn't have TikTok then, so it had to be IG stories. That's where that originated.
Yes, IG stories. So just like how I got my start, like basically if we want to start from the beginning, like I grew up in Hollywood, Florida. I'm bicultural. I'm half Salvadorian and half Jewish. Mm-hmm. So my fire and passion for life just exasperates my Jewish stomach. So definitely grew up very like confused with these two worlds and always struggled to find my identity in it. I would find it through writing. So mm-hmm. I would just constantly be writing about how I felt like a freak and how I felt like an underdog and an outsider. And then that sort of like led me to film school. I did film school and then I moved out to Los Angeles and I did the NBC Writers Diversity Program. So mm-hmm. I applied to that and got in and they actually helped me land my first job on Whitney. So it was an NBC show and she was allowed to hire one diversity writer from the program. And I just went in and I was like, I got to get this job. So I went in like 8 Mile, like really like went in hard. Like I was just like,
you just started freestyling. And yeah. And I was like, this is it.
Exactly.
She's our woman.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I wore great heels. I knew that she was into shoes and I got the job. Yeah, it was like really, and it was amazing. I was in this room with all these veteran comedy writers and they were so fast mm-hmm. and they were just like pitching and going so quickly. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't feel like I belong here. And like, I had to start taking propranolol because I would, so I wouldn't sweat through my pitches. Uh-huh. Eventually I got comfortable and I realized that I deserved to be there. And there was a reason I was there. I had a lot to contribute.
Yeah.
And then my confidence grew over the years.
I have to bring up the fact that you were a writer on A Dog with a Blog, mm-hmm. Because I worked with one of your other fellow writers, a guy named Chad Gervich, who I think you can go ahead and confirm is a monster.
I haven't actually met with Chad.
Then you really yeah. dodged a couple of bullets. No, Chad is a wonderful writer. So if you're out there, Chad, love to hear from you, buddy. So now because the majority of our audience are filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers, not a lot of them have a lot of experience when it comes to television. So mm-hmm. television is so much different than film and independent film because yes. with independent film, like one day you're a director, the next day you're a gaffer. Whereas with television, there are a series of steps. There are rungs in which to go up.
Mm-hmm.
Assistant writer, and then you're a staff writer, and then, you know, a co-producer, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, mm-hmm. like, go through a little bit of that. Like, what was your kind of stepping stone process through all of it?
Yeah, what was interesting is, like, I originally thought I was going to be an independent filmmaker. I went to film school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I had a short film that played Tribeca. And ooh. Like, I thought I was going to be this indie feminist filmmaker. And yeah. I would apply to Sundance Lab and they would not get in because like my stuff was never edgy enough. It was too funny. Uh-huh. I just like kept on just struggling to get to break into indie film. And it was just never, I guess my voice wasn't edgy enough. But then, you know, this NBC program opportunity came about because I made an independent short film, actually, that played the NBC Film Festival they have. And then I met all the diversity people and they were like, you should apply to our program. And I'm like, I don't know how to write for TV. What's TV? Like, what's the process? Like,
yeah.
And then I discovered there's more than one writer and like the actors don't write the show. Like, I had all these discoveries. And when I got into my first room, I'm like, oh, this is where I belong. And so basically you start out as a staff writer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first step. Some people do come in through as writer's assistants and they get promoted or script coordinators and they get promoted. But I start out as a staff writer. And then if you're lucky enough to get your next gig, you'll move up to story editor and then executive story editor and then co-producer, producer, supervising producer, co-EP.
Yeah.
So there's like many steps and every season you'll move up. but it's very challenging. You mm-hmm. know, there's a lot of people competing for these slots. But being part of a writer's room is just such a beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. Like, you are in a room with smart, in a comedy room, you're just like with the funniest people you've ever met. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you can just like throw away all your friends because they're trash compared to
this is our blurb for your episode. Yes. This is great. Okay.
Yes. So you end up in a comedy room with just like the smartest, funniest people, and you become like a family, and mm-hmm. you're riffing off each other. So you're with people that are making you a better writer, mm-hmm. and it's an incredible experience. And I think it was sort of a not a hard transition to go from, you know, writing features to writing for television. It's a different format, and you have to learn the structure and everything, but you know, it's sort of the storytelling is all the same.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick side mission here. Mm-hmm. So is that independent filmmaker side of you just gone? Like, listen, now I'm a TV person. That is it. Or is there
if Sundance calls me, I'm not going to like not pick up.
Damien Chazelle is just like, you know what? Here, you take this one.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So now you wrote on a few shows and then you jumped up to co-EP on One Day at a Time.
Mm-hmm.
So talk me through like that transition. So you're going from the room where you've thrown away all your friends and now you're in this writer's room, but now you're the co-EP. So what kind of now new duties do you have to take on? And also, are you able to have that same kind of relationship with the writers in the room? Because now you're deciding what is going and what is not going.
Well, it was, you know, it was many years. So I was like building up my confidence, but yeah, and is at a co. I mean, you're essentially everybody's kind of doing the same job. You're just like there's just more expected of you, I think, mm-hmm. because you have that experience in the room. So you're gonna be expected to pitch more and contribute more. And if you don't, then you're not gonna get your next gig. Yeah. So that's sort of like it's just an expectation level. But becoming a showrunner is a whole other ball game.
Well, tell me about that. What was I mean? So yeah, you went in and you pitched this, and you said like you jumped quite a few different rungs there. So
yeah.
Now I know the WGA has got classes for first-time showrunners as well, and that you go ahead and take some of that. But I'm willing to bet
no class can prepare you for the job
exactly
at all. Like,
yeah.
And no, I mean, I can talk to people at length about what the job is and what's required, but you just don't know. You just don't know until you're in it. It's like, I guess, having a child. Like, you don't know until, like, yeah. You talk about being a parent, but you don't know until you're in it. And that's what it's like. It's like, it's so intense. You are navigating. You have 300 people working for you, and they all have different personalities and different needs. And you have to be just very collaborative. You have to be very on top of things. Like, it's very much a management position. And so you have to have that sort of like type A part of your brain to activate, which you don't have to have when you're just in a room. You're just creative and just pitching jokes and stories. But suddenly when you're a boss, you're like, you've got to answer like 300 emails a day and you have to be able to do that. Yeah, it's just it's a lot to navigate. It's not for the faint of heart.
Sure. Well, to go off that, you know, you're talking about your bosses. You got the chance to work with Norman Lear. Who, for those of you who don't know, mm-hmm. where have you been for the last 50 years? He's done some of like the biggest television shows ever. And so did you ever have a chance to sit down and talk with him, get advice?
So Norman would come into the One Day at a Time room once in a while. You know, he's like, he's, what is he now, 100?
He's an old gentleman. Yes.
But he would come in and he was sharp and he would like pitch jokes and like it would be like just incredible. And you're just like, I'm sitting with a legend. Like, this is incredible. And, you know, I had one interaction with him. I remember on set where I went up to him. I said, you know, what's the key to life? Because he's so, you know, and he's basically like, stay curious. Like, everyone has a story. And so ask them about their life, like, and, you know, just stay curious. And I thought that was really beautiful. And I've held that with me.
That is a great one. Now, you've been fortunate in your career. You've worked on some very traditional television shows where you have a 22 or 23 episode order.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've also worked on some smaller ones as well, where it's just like you have an 8 to 13 episode deal, which do you find that there's positive and negatives in having a larger order or smaller order?
Yeah, I would say with a smaller order, it's not as challenging. I mean, obviously, making 22 episodes as opposed to 13 is going to be easier.
Yeah.
You only have to come up with 13 ideas, but coming up with 22 ideas gets a little more challenging. I love the challenge of it, though. But definitely, like, we started out with 13 on Lopez versus Lopez, and when we got that back nine, I definitely, like, there was a little bit of panic that set in. I'm like, how am I going to do nine more of these? Like, do I have it in me? But then I did. I realized I did. Just because, like, I think our characters are so well developed and our cast is just so amazing that they're just so easy to write for.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not easy, but we just know who these characters are so well. And so there's just, like, so many different stories that we can come up with for them. So it has to be a show that just, like, has really strong characters. And then you'll be able to develop many, many episodes.
But also, it seems like when you have a longer order, when you have a 22 or a 23 order, then younger writers who maybe, you know, don't have as much experience, you know, are able to get to set, you know, who are able to kind of like, shadow a showrunner or, you know, kind of get a better view of how the whole thing works. When you're just doing 8 to 13, there is less time that you're allowed on set because things are moving so quickly.
Yeah.
Now that you're a showrunner, are you trying to set up paths for your writers to one day eventually grow up to become showrunners?
Absolutely. So actually, you know, I worked on a show called Dog with a Blog.
Oh, yes.
And on that show, I actually, my showrunner, Michael Kaplan, took us through all the steps of his job of showrunning. So for our individual episodes that we would write, he took us through. We got to, you know, be involved in all the decision makings from, you know, props, costumes. He would take us into the editing. He would take us all the way to the sound mix. Mm-hmm. And that was so beneficial. I've used all those skills I learned from him. All the skills I learned on Dog with a Blog, I use in Lopez versus Lopez. And I've continued that with my staff because I want a lot of showrunners don't bother training. But like, if we don't train, then where are our future showrunners? Like, it's going to be like people just thrown into the job, not knowing at all what they're doing. You're not setting them up for success.
And did you find, because of course, when you're a writer, you just have to worry about writing your episode. And of course, there are certain guardrails that you have to. This is the amount of pages that we're going to get to. These are the amount of like locations that we have. But when you talk about like going into the edit room or having to talk to executives, like what was that process like for you? How were you learning to do that when you were coming up and pitching and trying to finesse an idea towards a, you know, an executive who maybe is just not on board with what it is you're trying to tell?
We're very fortunate. We have really great execs that just are very collaborative. And yeah, they'll tear something apart every once in a while. But I always love it. I think it's a challenge. And, you know, Bruce Helford, who did the original Lopez, and he also was my boss on The Conners. He's a legend. He's did Drew Carey show, many, many different shows. He said to me, you can always make a script better. Mm-hmm. So, and he's like, so take the note, try to take the notes, make them feel heard, and you can, and that's what we do every episode. And it always works. Like, you're always like, I'm always go in with like, we can make this better.
Mm-hmm. And when you're getting into the edit, take me through a little bit of that, because I'm sure, are you in the editing bay as a writer, or is it just, it wasn't until you were a showrunner that you were really like going through all of those processes?
Yeah. So in Dog with a Blog, I got to go into the edit bay and learn the process. Also, you know, my film school background, I got to also edit my own short films, as you do, like those 4 a.m. in the edit bay days. Like, that all helped me when I've got into the edit bay on my own show.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I probably drive my editor. He's wonderful, Richie. I probably drive him crazy because I probably know more than a lot of showrunners about editing. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, can you trim a few frames here? And he's like, okay. But, you know, a few frames can make a difference.
Oh, comedy has to be so fast. Come like, there's on. It's absolutely timing.
Exactly. So, and he's a wonderful, incredible editor. And he's so patient with me. But yeah, like going into the edit bay, I just felt like it was second nature to me since I already had know how to edit.
Did you have any performance background? Was there ever a time where you're like, you know what? I'm funny. Like, I'm going to give stand-up comedy a shot.
Oh, Lord, no. No. I have a Jewish stomach. I mentioned that, right? It's not. Performing is not
You
for
might
me.
Be surprised. There's a few Jewish comedians.
There are. There There's are a few. I don't know how they don't shit themselves every time they're on stage.
That's a great bit. Yeah. If you can shit yourself on stage, oh, yeah, man, it is. You're a headliner right
yeah,
away.
Yeah, right? Success overnight. Yeah, no, I've taken, but I do recommend to all comedy writers to take improv classes because it will help you in the room, because that's what the room is. The room is a giant improv room and you're just riffing off each other and you're, you know, and so to be able to do that and have the confidence to do that, improv really helps you gain those skills.
Yeah. Now, going back to when you were a writer, you know, you get that first show, like you're on Whitney, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then that show ends or you move on to something else. Mm-hmm. What is the best way? Because I feel like that's where a lot of writers can stall out.
Yeah.
There can be a lot of problems because it's like, well, I used all my connections to get that job. Like, what do I have now to get the next job? So take me through some of that. What were you doing?
I didn't work for a year after my first gig, and I was I repeated staff writer 4 times actually. Mm-hmm. And it happens a lot to women and minorities, unfortunately, because we're still coming up in the game. Mm-hmm. And it was a struggle, and I was really nervous. I didn't know if I'd get my next job, but what I did is I just kept in touch with everyone I knew, you know, every writer that I knew on Whitney. Like, I would, like, you know, there was one writer, Liz Astroff, that I was obsessed with because she was just so funny. And she did spin class. So I would, like, just go to her spin. I would go across. I would drive an hour in traffic to go to her spin class. Uh-huh. Just so I could be around her.
That's amazing.
And just, like, you know, just, like, absorb who she was and, like, why she was successful. And, you know, she would talk to me after spin class. And I just, like, networking is just so important because mm-hmm. that's how you'll get your next gig. My agents actually did, I mean, this doesn't happen often, but my agents actually did get me the job on Dog with a Blog.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was great, but it didn't happen for a year. And I would just tell people, like, you just don't give up.
Yeah.
You can't give up.
Going back to what you were talking about as far as, like, being a woman, you know, being a minority. Mm-hmm. Now, I feel like that has gotten a lot of press in the last, I would say, 5-10 years, something like that. Yeah. Have you really, like, you're a boots on the ground, you are in the trenches, you are working. Have you really seen that change? Or do you think a lot of it is just kind of fodder for headlines and, you know, exciting blog posts?
I do see change. Just the fact that I'm in this position mm-hmm. right now. Back when I started, there was, I don't remember any female showrunners that I could think of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Shonda Rhimes was around 10 years ago, right? Other than her, like, I just, like, there just wasn't a lot. And now I see, now I have a lot of my peers are showrunners, which is really exciting. There's still not a lot of, like, Latine showrunners in the game, but that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to train the future. I think that that's what's so important, because, like, once we get into these power positions, we have to inspire the next crop to, like, come up and get there too. So that's, I'm really dedicated to that.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're a person with just a geyser of ideas. Mm-hmm. So when you are finding something, it's just like, naturally, you know, you've got your project ahead of you. You've got Lopez versus Lopez. Like, everything has to kind of funnel there. Mm-hmm. But when you have an idea or something that's, this is kind of like a side project. Like, do you have a couple of those cooking, or is it just like, nope, everything is going into this pot?
Oof. Last year I had, while I was making Lopez, I had a pilot over at Disney Channel. And I got to tell you, making a pilot while you're running a network sitcom, that is not, I don't recommend it. Yeah. Like, my Thanksgiving was spent, you know, writing and picking out props and, like, so yeah, it's very, if you want to work all the time, then you'll have multiple projects. But I've decided this year, I just, you know, focusing on Lopez is what I need to do.
Yeah. So if you're giving advice to women, to minorities, to anyone out there who wants to be, you know, in the position that you're at now, like, you know, and they're starting off, they're the young woman who's in, you know, film school, or the young woman who's, you know, in high school watching television and saying, like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
What is your advice to them?
Move to Los Angeles. Okay. Is the first part. And the next part is just, like, have coffee with everyone you can that is connected in some way to what you know, to the television business. You know, like, I was fortunate to have this mentor early on, Ligia Villalobos, who I met through a friend of a friend of a friend or something. Mm-hmm. I asked her, I was like, you know, how do I become how do I get into TV? You know, she gave me, like, sort of some ideas. She's like, you need to write a spec script and you need to do this and you need to do that. And just having that mentorship was key. And so that's what I recommend. But don't go in, like, in terms of networking, a lot of people go in being like, what can you do for me? Mm-hmm. That's not the way to network. The way to network is going in with curiosity, mm-hmm. like Norman Lear said, and go in and ask questions, you know, and learn. And then people will like you. People love to talk about themselves. So,
especially in Los Angeles.
Especially in LA.
We love talking about us.
People love, yeah. So if you take someone out for a coffee and have them talk about themselves for an hour, they're going to love you.
Yeah.
And then you just keep building that network and of people. And then eventually that's how you'll get your first job.
What's some things that's like, look, these are great things to do. What are some things just not to do? Like, don't be that guy. What's that guy doing?
just don't be entitled. Uh-huh. Don't think. I mean, when I moved out to LA, I thought I was like someone was going to hand me a feature film. Mm-hmm. I really did. And very quickly, early on, someone put me in my place. And she's like, you know, the way that you're communicating, like she's like, girl, you don't know what the struggle is out here. Like, you just need to calm down.
Yeah.
Like, I would write these emails like, I'm going to be a director tomorrow. And so don't have that attitude.
I don't know. That sounds like a lot of ambition. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but it was like too much. Just come in with humility and curiosity, and yeah, don't come in with like a huge ego. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not the way to go.
It's a good call. We go to our final six questions, which are kind of like rapid fire questions. What is the first film you made and how do you feel about it now? And this could be something you made in the backyard with your friends when you were a kid. This could be like a high school project, whatever it is.
Oh, the first film I made. And gosh, let me think about this. Well, I'm thinking about my college film that I got to shoot on Super 35.
Ooh.
Yeah.
35, not the 16. They gave the kids the real good stuff.
Yeah, I got the grant for the Super 35. It was called Cat's Bad Hair Day, and it was like about like a coming of age story of a girl whose boobs were so big and she was ashamed of them and she gets her period in a tub. It was very like, very much like a girl in film school's first film. Like,
I was going to say,
all the tropes.
Your feminist indie filmmaker roots are absolutely showing
right
now.
Yes, yeah. Yes, they are. But it got into Tribeca, so... What was the question about?
Well,
that
just one? Kind of what is the first one and how you feel about it now?
Oh, like, how
have
I
you
feel
revisited
about
it,
now?
It in
it's
whatever?
It's good. Time? Yeah. I watched it recently. I was like, this is good. This is like got some really like there's slow motion shots. It's really beautiful.
I do have to
proud
just
of it.
I'm going to go on a little side tangent as well. So you've mentioned grants a couple of times. So how often were you writing grants or trying to get like some of these other something that would require you as a writer, but not writing scripts? Like, you know, when you are writing something to get yourself out there, like, was that a muscle that you already had, like writing essays or things like that?
Yeah, no, I had to learn it. But like, that's another thing that I would recommend to all young writers is just apply to as many programs as you can. A lot of people have trouble with motivation and finishing things.
Yeah.
I would always use these like screenwriting deadlines, like whatever, you know, thing it is. If it's like the prize is like, you know, a gift certificate to the Cheesecake Factory is like what you get for applying to this, like this thing.
It's a good gift certificate.
A good gift certificate. You should still apply because then you're going to like finish something. And then you're going to get good at essay writing too, because there's always like an essay portion. So
great.
Applying to everything, I think, is important.
What is the best, we say best filmmaking advice, but what is the kind of the best, I would say, writing advice that you ever got?
The best writing advice I ever got? I don't think I've ever been asked that question.
I like to ask the tough ones.
I know. Yeah. It's really
Well, you know, I think you kind of gave it a bit of an answer to it with Norman Lear. It's just like staying curious. It just
yeah.
seems to be like, that's a great...
Staying curious. I don't know. It's like advice I gave to myself.
Still counts.
Yeah.
Clearly you're a successful person, so you got it from a successful person.
Yes. Something I've always done is I've never been able to like write like from a fake place, I guess. Like mm-hmm. every story I always write like comes from my life or people I know, their life. And so... I would just say, just be authentic. And like, that's where you're going to tell the best stories. Like, even if it is like a supernatural, like aliens, whatever, at the core of it, what is it about? And it should be about like an authentic, like human experience that either you've had or you've seen someone go through very intimately and like write from that. And that's what good writing is.
Another kind of side question then. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that when you sit down to write, you're always the avatar that where you start. Mm-hmm. So is it open on young El Salvadorian and Jewish woman, like, you know, at a coffee shop? And then you're like, maybe we should, okay, we got to change some of these parts here. But like, is that where you're starting? And then you're just like, okay, we're going to swap in somebody else here. You know, but this is my journey.
Yes. I mean, kind of in a way, it's like starting from like a feeling or mm-hmm. like, you know, how did I feel that day? Or, you know, what is something that I'm going through that I want to work out? Like, that's where I start.
Usually. Great. Conversely, what is some of the worst advice you've ever gotten when it comes to the industry?
The worst advice I've ever gotten. I don't think I've ever gotten like bad advice.
Wow.
Yeah. Sorry.
All right. No, that's fair.
I don't think I've ever received any. Well, I've been really lucky to have great mentors.
Yeah. Well, I've got enough bad advice for the both of us. We're all set.
Okay.
Do you have a goal as a writer and a filmmaker?
I think my goal is to continue to keep Latinas in television. Mm-hmm. There's so few of us.
Yeah.
And that's been a long goal of me since I started out. Like, I didn't see my family represented enough on screen. And all the stories I tend to tell are Latine stories. And so, not that they're Latine stories, but that they're human stories. But then having Latine representation, like casting Latine talent, like that's really important to me. So I want to continue to do that. And yeah, in with Lopez versus Lopez, but then also working with other Latine talent to create more shows.
Another kind of side thing, when you were young and starting off, did you ever feel like people were trying to pigeonhole you, or it's just like, oh, you need to go like write on a Spanish soap opera or something like that? were people just kind of like pushing you, or just like, oh, you're a girl, so you're going to go do like this girl show or something like that? Or did you feel like, no, like, oh, I was given, you know, these opportunities?
Yeah, it was once in a room where they're like, oh, we need something about shopping right now. So, and I was the only woman in the room. They're like, Debbie. I'm like, oh, God. So that does happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like.
So your managers never were like, listen, this telenovela is coming up. We got to get you on there.
So I will say, like, it's hard to get that job. And like, they want to be able to brand you. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to have a brand.
Yeah.
But, you know, use it. Use that brand to get into these rooms. And then, you know, and then you'll be able to rise up the ranks and then create whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. It's very good advice. Yeah. If you could go back and give yourself one piece of advice, you just gave a great one right there. But if you could go back and give yourself a piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say, okay, I'm going through like a spiritual journey right now.
All right. I like it.
And I would say, learn how to love yourself.
Hmm.
Because like getting into this business, there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of crazy energy, chaotic energy surrounding the film and TV business. Like it's like here to star today, gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
And at the core of it, if you don't love yourself, you're going to have a hard time navigating it.
Mm-hmm.
So just like that's something that's so key, and like finding ways to do that, you know, through meditation, positive affirmations. And a lot of people become writers because they don't love themselves.
Yeah.
and they're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And writing is a form of therapy. But like recognizing that early on and working on loving yourself is something that I would have said to my younger self.
Yeah. I started off as a stand-up comic, and mm-hmm. All stand-up comedians are just very even level people who have a very healthy relationship about themselves and others.
They do.
Great. Sorry you didn't get that.
I know.
Final question. Yeah. Is show running hard?
Very hard. Very hard. Harder than I ever imagined.
Do you want to keep going at this point? Or you're like, yes. Can I just go back to staff writing? Can I just do that?
You know, like last year, I would joke. I'd be like, you know, I just want to be a staff writer at Abbott Elementary. I love that show.
Great show.
Yeah, it's a great show. And I would say that all the time. But then I actually, like, I love this job.
Yeah.
I absolutely love. And I love being the boss. Everyone has to laugh at all your jokes.
So that's what it is.
Yes. And it's sweet when you get there. But no, just like just being able to like be creative and create this thing and just that I'm so proud of. Like, I just love it so much. I'm so thankful.
Very good. Debbie Wolf, how do people support you? How do people find you? How do people find Lopez versus Lopez?
Yeah. So Lopez versus Lopez is now streaming on Peacock. It's actually going to be streaming on Netflix starting November 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back on NBC next year, early next year. People can follow me. I'm on the Instagram at Debbie Wolf, DebbyWolfe. And yeah, give me a follow.
I thought you were going to throw out your TikTok as well, because that's where this journey all started.
My dog has a TikTok, but I don't. He's a star.
Please give me your dog's TikTok. How do we follow your dog?
I think it's at Mescalito is a star.
So in season four of Lopez versus Lopez, when your dog shows up, we should not be surprised.
Yeah, we should not.
No. It's going to be a whole side
journey. He's a star, but like he gets in his own way because he has anger issues. So. Oh, man. I know.
It's,
I know.
It's tale as old as time.
Yes, he doesn't love himself.
He's got to do some more meditation.
He's got to do some more meditating.
Eric, do you have anything to share about Eric's chat with Debbie?
I just remember that Eric Toms was like such a gem, and he went to Austin by himself because I couldn't go this year because of this guy, my son. He did like 6 or 7 interviews in one day, and like I thought I had a list, but I guess I did, but then people came in last minute or whatever. So like I was didn't really know, but besides like the main people, like who he was interviewing, and he would just like, he was so pumped. He would send us pictures all day of him with like the people that he interviewed, and he'd be like, Debbie Wolf. And like Liz and I are like, what?
No, we totally know who Debbie Wolf is, and we're very excited, but we didn't know what he was talking about because he would just throw names into the text.
Well, I looked her up as soon as he said that because I was like, just to remember who she was. And I was like, oh, damn, like this person is hell of impressive.
Yeah.
I was like, she wrote on all these huge shows. She, you know, the Connors and, you know, lots of other things. And then like she was showrunner, like co-creator of Lopez versus Lopez. And so I was just like, oh, shit, like that's a humongous win. So like. It was funny because it was all like within 30 seconds. Like he sent that message. I remember your response was like, who's that?
No, I was like, I don't remember that at all. I remember being very excited about Debbie Wolf.
And then at that same time, I looked her up and I was like, holy shit, this person's impressive. So I just thought like I was really excited that we got her on the show. So thank you, Eric, for making that happen. And I really hope people enjoy this interview. I haven't heard it yet. I'm sure I'll listen to this one because... sounds way up my alley, although I don't listen to podcasts anymore, which is weird for someone who has a podcast. But yeah, no, but thanks, Eric, for doing that. It's really great. It is time for this week's expert question, whatever this is. I'm going to call it Ask the Expert because I still like that. Although You're the Expert's fun, too. But anyways, this is a segment that our producer, Eric Toms, came up with where, you know, he filters in questions from the audience. Some he comes up with, some from audience members, and these are questions that he knows that we will be the expert on. So here is this week's question. I've been shooting a lot of shorts with my friends, and productions have been increasing in complexity. Due to the size and duration of our upcoming shoots, some locations are now starting to ask for production insurance. Should I buy this myself? Liz, well, yeah. Take it away.
I think what I'm supposed to say in a public forum is, yes, you should buy your production insurance yourself and have it be specifically tied to the production. But I will say that some individuals form a co-production with a production company in order to utilize their production insurance because it is expensive to buy an individual policy per production. And some production companies just have an ongoing policy that you could take part in by filling out some paperwork and being accountable to them. And collaborating creatively. So I would say, yeah, you should always be insured. Insurance is important in the indie film sphere, but you might not always have to buy out an individual policy per production. And Eric, do you have other advice or counter advice?
Yeah, just that like you're supposed to do it that way, right? You're supposed to have it be specific to that movie. But yeah, I think doing it the other way is the best way. And for the longest time, for a low budget movie, I should say, especially a short film. And I had my own production insurance for my business. So I would just use my own for a lot, you know, of it, which was totally worked, you know. But yeah, if you don't have your own, finding a somebody that you do know who has their own production insurance for their production company, that's like a really great way to go. You can also find, and this is more like a cautionary tale. Like you can find companies that will insure you for like a weekend or for 3 days or something. And it's totally like kind of not real, you know? It's like you pay for this piece of paper that says you have the insurance and like you can get the rentals that you need and the production and all that stuff, you know? But like if something was to happen when you have one of those kinds of policies, you're really not protected because it's just a really like cheap, quick way to like get the actual certificate that you need. So I would just say like, that's not a bad option. I just say, be aware, like when you're doing these things, like what it actually means. Like if you were to have a problem, like, you know, you should have an awareness of what you're protected against and what you're not protected against, you know? But the best way is to just take out an insurance claim for the movie, for, you know, whatever it is. Yeah, like I think you could do 3 months or 6 months, or sometimes it's just a, you just have to do it for a year. I can't remember. I haven't done it in a long time, but I did that for my first short film, and it was expensive. It felt good to do it the right way for once. But you know, I mean, I did co-productions on like my feature and like on most of my shorts, so I feel like doing the co-production route is totally a good way to go for sure. But I would also say for a short film, there's also, yeah, depending on what you're doing, you probably don't need insurance. So if I would say don't spend money on it unless you need it. Is that fair or is that bad advice? That's just how I feel like, because based off of when making all my movies, it's like if there's not a need, then don't do it. You know, maybe that's, I feel like this is terrible advice. But everyone should get insurance. Everyone should have it just to be safe. But yeah, what do you guys think of this question? Let us know. You can send us a comment, question, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, which my son agrees would be great. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Make sure to check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're a great organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs, which is awesome. Check them out at www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks so much to Debbie Wolf for coming on the show. Thanks to Austin Film Fest for having us back this year and the Omni Hotel for hosting us in their podcast room. Huge, huge thanks to Eric Toms for setting up this interview. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for doing our social media. And big thanks to all of you for listening. And Benny also agrees. Thank you. So have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.